I'm Joanne Gallagher, your Think Future podcast host. Today, James Slattery of the San Francisco government joins the program to tell an inspiring story of engagement and leadership as the city moves towards zero waste, reducing consumption in the built environment. This podcast is brought to you by Arcons, a global leader pioneering solutions and services to the AEC and manufacturing industries to support digital transformation for the built environment and smart manufacturing. Visit arcons.net to learn more about how Arcons are helping organizations design, build, and solve through digitalization. From Arcons to you, welcome to our Think Future podcast series. Each week, we'll share conversations with industry leaders from around the world to find out how they're thinking future. Subscribe to Arcons Think Future for access to more episodes, interviews, and profiles. James Slattery is the Senior Coordinator of San Francisco's Construction and Demolition Zero Waste Program. James has worked with the San Francisco Environmental Department for over 11 years. His work focuses on resource conservation, waste reduction and material recovery strategies, and environmental action in solid waste management. He joins the program to tell us about the life cycle of buildings in the Bay Area and the sustainable outcomes they have achieved with green buildings, zero waste, reduced toxicity, environmental justice, and climate action. Welcome to the program, James.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
James, tell us about your sustainability background and how you ended up with such a challenging role working for the local government of San Francisco.
Well, my sustainability background begins with somewhat of a desperate exit from my previous career, which was in the financial services industry. And I say desperate in that I was desperately longing and searching for a connection to more meaningful work. And as I left one career and embarked on the pursuit of discovering the career I'm in now, I returned to school and went to study here in San Francisco in their local universities and environmental science program, environmental science and studies. And that sort of kicked things off and put me on a trajectory to work here at San Francisco's Environment Department upon graduating that program. And I was trying to merge a former skill set where I was recruiting and developing a workforce in the financial services industry. And I landed here at the Environment Department in San Francisco. My first role was to help coordinate the day-to-day green jobs training program that we have. We call it Environment Now. It was the result of a economic stimulus package from the then Obama, President Obama administration. And what we were doing was trying to offer an on-ramp into the professional environmental movement for folks who might not have the necessary credentials. And the aim was to recruit, hire, and train folks from the communities that we were in service to better represent our work, our programs. So I was tasked with helping craft that program, implement it on the day-to-day, work with the participants. And the toolkit I was handed was a suite of policies and programs related to zero waste. And I used these policies and programs to ramp up the professional skills of the training program participants. And so these were folks who were, they probably did not have a college degree, may have not have had a high school degree. Some were formerly incarcerated. Many were, English was a second language. We had folks who had left the workforce 15, 16, 17 years ago to parent their children and were returning. And, you know, the whole workforce had transformed. They didn't have email accounts, let alone, you know, work with Microsoft Excel and PowerPoint. And so I started to use these outreach programs rooted in zero waste to try to develop the professional skills of these participants. And that gave me a knowledge base deeply rooted in zero waste principles and programs and policies, enough that I could then pivot out of that initial role into the one I have today, which is working on our zero waste program team, but I specialize in construction and demolition debris recovery. And that's where I've been spending my time for the last 7 or 8 years and started at the end of life, looking at when we're demolishing structures, what happens with the resources that are in them, how do we recover them? And slowly that evolved into thinking about the upstream considerations, not just how can we pick through the waste and find resources that could maybe be recycled or downcycled, but how can we prevent the waste in the first place? And so for the last almost 5 years now, I've had a hybrid role with the Department of Environment here. I've been focused on the construction and demolition, debris recovery, end of life laws and programs that are in place. And I started working more closely with our green building team to work with the architects, the owners, the developers, designers, contractors, to start looking at waste prevention and material reuse and other concepts that can avoid that strain that we're faced with of trying to pick through and recover resources from the end of life, if you will.
So that's very impressive background. You have the skill set anyway to lead. That's for sure.
Thank you.
What is the Global Climate Action Summit? What's that about and when did that start?
Yeah, that's somewhat related to a little bit of the overview I provided. So in 2018, California's governor at the time, Jerry Brown, Governor Brown, hosted something called the Global Climate Action Summit. And that was in response to the then President Trump administration withdrawing from the Paris Accords, pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Accords. And then Governor Brown's response was, well, I'm going to convene a group of subnationals, and that's just, you know, UN speak for anyone who's not a nation. So it was a majority representation were cities here in the U.S., but there was certainly an international presence there. So it was convened with the intent to keep the U.S. and other countries, I should say other nations, on track to meet the Paris Accord, but from a groundswell of the local, smaller jurisdiction, municipality up. And the result of that summit was a set of agreements, pledges, and commitments for how the aims of the Paris Accord could be fulfilled. Again, I was working in the lane of zero waste. And so the pledges that landed with the program area that I work with started to shift the focus and reinvent what zero waste meant. I would call this a move from zero waste 1.0 into 2.0. And 1.0 was, again, looking at end of life and saying, hey, how do we cut down what's going into the landfill? You know, let's eliminate or reduce, if not eliminate, what we dispose of or incinerate. The pledges out of the Zero Waste, out of the Global Climate Action Summit, the Zero Waste 2.0, if you will, started to layer on a new lens. And that lens was taking into consideration the impacts to the atmospheric carbon problem. So the greenhouse gas emissions that result even from those desirable outcomes of landfill diversion, meaning even recycling something is going to have an adverse impact potentially on the atmosphere. So how do we look at zero waste as also thinking about waste prevention, not just landfill diversion? And so the pledges that came out of that, and I think 40 cities initially signed on to this pact, this set of pledges, was a refinement of zero waste objectives. There was still a commitment to reducing landfill disposal. So that goal became cut what's going into your landfill by 50% by 2030 and using 2015's numbers as a baseline. The new lens added a pledge of reduce the overall waste generation by 15% by 2030. And so to give some scale and context, at that time, San Francisco was sending about 600,000 tons a year to the landfill. And we were generating, though, as a total solid waste generation, 3 million tons of waste. So 600,000 being put in the hole in the ground, cut that in half by 2030. And of the 3 million tons that you're generating that go to recycling infrastructure, composting infrastructure, hopefully reuse as well, and disposal of that, drop that by 15% by 2030. And so that was really what I ended up taking away from the Global Climate Action Summit, and I ended up bringing back to my program area and infusing that new mission into my role, which at that time was the coordinator of the Construction and Demolition Zero Waste Program.
Wow, there's a lot of stats there. How do you bring that down to, you know, an individual level, that kind of waste? Do you know what that equates to per person?
I don't know how we break that out per person. And I'm sure we've tried to do that. We have tried to break it by sector, meaning per business, per employee, per resident. But my lane that I'm swimming in the construction and demolition sector, the building industry, it's a little more challenging to nail it down because it's not as static per se as the number of residents that are here or the number of employees that are on tax rolls. I can't give you a number there on a per construction project basis, but I could give some other numbers to give scale to the ecosystem here in San Francisco. At that time in 2018, our Department of Building Inspection was permitting upwards of 60,000 building activities a year. These are new construction, alterations, demolitions, commercial, residential. We had hundreds of hauling companies moving debris out of the city and transporting it all over the San Francisco Bay Area to disposal facilities, to recycling facilities, to compost facilities. And my role at that time was we were hyper-focused on commingling debris and regulating that. That was the preferred strategy of a building activity, was to just throw it all into a debris box or a skip, let somebody else sort through it and figure out how to pick through it. If there's something valuable that could be recovered, let them redirect it to a recycling market. And this has its advantages, but the trade-offs there are that a lot of the material that could have been recovered ends up degraded or destroyed in that process. And so the only home for it at the end of the day was the landfill. So we're hyper-focused on this preferred strategy of how to manage construction discards, mixed debris. And so I was tasked with looking at 50 to 60,000 building projects a year, the hundreds of hauling companies deploying thousands of vehicles throughout the city, and then probably about 15 facilities that were receiving mixed debris and sorting through it with all sorts of technology, from really simple approaches of just put it on the floor and have a crew of hand sorters go through it, up to using robotics, AI robotics, powerful magnets, density float tanks, all sorts of things to figure out how to get as many recoverable resources out of that stream and divert it into recycling and composting. And again, the shift around that time was to say, that's fine. Let's wring as much water out of the towel of what we're doing there in terms of resource recovery. But knowing that the focus has shifted from landfill diversion to what are the impacts to the atmosphere, the realization at that point is we're not going to be able to recycle our way out of a climate crisis. So, James, you and your team pivot and start to partner more deeply with the Green Building Program and start to talk with and engage with the stakeholders that are upstream, move away from the recycling facilities and the haulers, and get in conversation with the owners, the architects, the contractors, and the developers, and see how practices can shift there, either voluntarily with program support like education and awareness, or through policy levers. And so that's where a lot of my time has been spent in the last few years.
Well, thanks for explaining that. That's very clear, and you've given a very interesting picture so everyone can understand what your role is and the value you're bringing to the sector. So, James, what came about from having the Zero Waste and the Green Buildings teams partner?
The result was initially an ad hoc working group of two, myself and the Green Building Program coordinator, and we named ourselves the Building Materials Management Team. And from there, we really started to research and develop what are the possible interventions that could manifest that makes sense for our department to lead and steward when trying to disrupt the building industry's linear material flow of, you know, take, make, waste. And again, all in support of these new zero waste commitments and pledges, namely, how do you reduce the generation of waste? And so we really did lay out all the nodes of the ecosystem, all of the practices, and started to map out what could be an intervention. And from that list, we try to determine what makes sense for our department to take on and start to invest time and energy into researching. One of the first things that were born from that effort, and it was sort of serendipitous, as I was working with my colleague on the green building team, Portland, Oregon, here in the U.S., our neighbor on the Pacific coast, had just passed the nation's first deconstruction ordinance, mandating the disassembly of structures rather than allowing the demolition of a structure to occur. And our federal agency, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, their region chapter that has both Portland and San Francisco under its belt, convened something called the Bay Area Deconstruction Working Group. And that was in response to what Portland accomplished. They said, look, if Portland can do it, the Bay Area should be able to do it as well. And so this working group emerged of local practitioners, folks who were already working in the practice of deconstruction. They could have been deconstruction contractors or material resellers who were receiving the salvage materials and redistributing them, reselling them. And then there was, the local policymakers. And this quickly grew and grew and grew. You know, this was a topic of interest nationwide. So it quickly expanded beyond just the Bay Area Deconstruction Working Group. And, you know, after the first two or three gatherings, they were quarterly gatherings, you know, we had something like 200 plus participants, and they were coming from coast to coast, folks from Canada. We would often even call in folks from beyond the North American ecosystem to share what they were doing with regards to trying to use deconstruction as an on-ramp to waste prevention and seeing material reuse as the low-hanging fruit to reducing what's called embodied carbon. Embodied carbon would be the emissions associated with that take, make, waste, linear material flow. It's all of the emissions that went into the structure that has been built that will ultimately be demolished. So from the raw materials being extracted to processed and manufactured to then transported for installation, not the emissions associated with operating a building. Think of that as the operational carbon, the lights, the elevators, the HVAC systems. It's the what went into constructing that. And so that came to be the task at hand was, how can we tackle the aim of reducing embodied carbon emissions through the lens of zero waste in this sector, the building sector? And the low-hanging fruit became, if we could just reuse what is here, we will have preserved the emissions that went into a particular product or material, and we can keep them in a structure, and you end up preserving the carbon that you've expended already to make that particular product, and you displace the new emissions you would have created by installing something from a virgin material procurement.
What other value did this research group add to the knowledge base in the Bay Area?
So the building material management team at San Francisco Environment Department, we looked at deconstruction. Think of it as the double helix of DNA. There's two strands there. Deconstruction is the practice that's going to liberate materials that could be reused. So the other strand is the reuse really is the ultimate outcome. If you're just going to deconstruct and disassemble and it doesn't have a way to migrate and be reintegrated into a new structure, then really all you're doing is inverting your landfill and bringing it above ground and having neatly organized piles of waste rather than destroyed, commingled discards that are going to be buried eventually. So to figure out how to get that ultimate outcome, reuse achieved, meant convening a new group of stakeholders that hadn't been talking before. So some of the things we started to do was convene groups like the Bay Area's All for Reuse Alliance. This is a working group of San Francisco Bay Area's largest real estate portfolio owners. many of the names are familiar to your listeners. You've got, you know, Google and Meta, Facebook, Salesforce. For us, it's, you know, Wells Fargo Bank is in there as well. And so this initial gathering of the owner node in the ecosystem was to raise awareness of the problem and the role they may be playing in driving some of the undesirable outcomes, whether it's landfill disposal or embodied carbon emissions, and garner pledges and commitments from that group to drive reuse outcomes. So we really did start to take on convening key stakeholders. So from that OAC node, the owner, architect, and contractors, we started to work closely with the owners through the All for Reuse Alliance. We started to work with the architects through the American Institute of Architects and their local San Francisco Bay Area chapter, and they have a zero waste working group as well. And we also started to work with contractor groups such as the Bay Area Sustainable Construction Leaders. So these are, you know, any of the contractors, if there's a French crane in the sky and there's a name on it, they're at this, they have sustainability directors at this particular working group. So we started to just be in conversation with everyone, garner an understanding of the mission at hand, and start to align interest and abilities towards achieving the objectives. And so stakeholder engagement was a primary lever of ours at the time. All of that then fed into the feeding into the research of potential policy interventions and programs that could be developed to support these practice shifts. And so I'd say that's maybe the greatest value that we brought online in a short period of time was to bring key stakeholders together and start talking about what could be done differently. And from those conversations, we started to get a clear picture of what other interventions might be appropriate. And those eventually found their way into San Francisco's Climate Action Plan, which was updated in 2021. We have a section of that Climate Action Plan that is called Responsible Production and Consumption. There's a number of strategies under there. The strategy that I'm speaking to right now is a strategy, the way it's termed, is to achieve total carbon balance across the buildings and infrastructure sectors. And there are seven supporting actions that essentially were developed, research developed, and refined in conversation with practitioners, with stakeholders, that are now captured in our Climate Action Plan and are driving the next phase of research and development interventions that may take shape as policy, programs, partnerships, any combination of the three.
Wow, you just described a huge amount of work. How long did all this take?
Yeah, the first conversation between myself and our green building coordinator took place in 2016. And I can remember that because our green building coordinator was hired then, and I was maybe 3 months into my new role. I had left that green job training program coordinator role, and I was in my new role of construction and demolition zero waste coordinator, and our green building coordinator was going around having her office introductions. Hello, I'm Eden Bruckman. Hi, I'm James Slattery. What do you do here? What do you do here? And we immediately kind of clicked on wood. We were both stoked to learn that Portland just passed a deconstruction ordinance. So we said hello in 2016, and we kicked off our Building Material Management Group in 2018, and the Climate Action Plan was updated in 2021, and I'm still working on it right now. Several of those supporting actions under that Responsible Production and Consumption chapter are my primary work plan today.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after a short break. Here's a little bit more about Archons. Archons has a mission to advance the efficiency, quality, and profitability of project outcomes for its customers by providing best-in-class technology and services. Are you looking for a digitalization and sustainability-focused partner to help you achieve your goals? Join the thousands of AEC and manufacturing customers globally who have turned to Archons to start their journey toward a better built environment and smarter manufacturing. With more than 50 locations around the world, Archons can connect you to the right technologies and expertise so you can improve your competitive position and increase profitability. Archons has an industry expert to help you navigate the best pathway forward wherever you are on your digitalization and sustainability journey. Visit archons.net to find out more. James, you mentioned responsible consumption a little bit a while ago, and I remember it's been said that Americans consume the rate of 5 times the planet's ability to renew itself. Is that still a fact, or have things changed?
You know, I've heard similar stats myself. I don't have those readily available off the top of my head, but overall, it does appear that waste is a design flaw. It's running throughout most key industry sectors. Building industry is no exception. There's also a distribution problem as well that needs to be addressed. And this is why we have a third lens, if you will, that's applied here. So the first lens was diverted from landfill. The second lens became consider the atmosphere, the impacts to atmospheric carbon. And the third lens is the equity lens. And the equity objective for us in the work that we're doing means increasing access to high quality building products and materials that would have otherwise gone to be downcycled or recycled or disposed, where there are communities, had they had known they were available, would have put these no to low cost, high quality products to use in their communities. And so there is an equity component as well, beyond just the atmosphere and the waste. But, you know, there are other stats you can throw at other than the, you know, how the rate of consumption of Americans. And this is taken from one of our working groups, the All for Reuse Alliance. We'll mention this pretty frequently, that there's over 2.5 billion square feet of commercial floor space being renovated every year globally. Commercial interior renovation projects here in the U.S. send about 32 million tons of waste to the landfill every year. Much of that is new condition product and material. You know, we replace these materials with similar ones. They also have to be extracted, manufactured, and delivered to the building. So this is not a problem that is isolated to the U.S. at this point. It is a global concern for how development is pursued when there is a 6-continent supply chain. Everybody wants to build with new materials, and the rate of development that we are building these structures at and then decommissioning them is unsustainable. So I think it's less about maybe what's happening here in the U.S. exclusively, and more about the footprint that this industry has globally and how practices can shift.
Okay, that's a very interesting perspective, because it is a global problem. So it's not just America, as you said. Can you go into the principles that drive the Government of San Francisco Climate Action Plan?
Yeah, sure. And I encourage folks to visit SF Environment's website, that's San Francisco Department of the Environment, and take a look at our Climate Action Plan from 2021. And you'll see the core principles driving climate action are things that we've touched on already. It's racial and social equity. It's community health. Just transitions as we move into a more sustainable economic and development framework. Economic recovery and resilience has actually kind of been elevated since we've gone through the pandemic and those global supply chains were disrupted. You know, there's overarching goals in there. There's obviously the greenhouse gas reduction. There's the goals of reducing consumption, advancing racial and social equity. So you'll see just about all of those overarching principles woven through the various strategies in that climate action plan. And then, and even some of them will call out specific metrics. For example, in the responsible production and consumption section I'm speaking of, my reminder here, it's to achieve total carbon balance across the buildings and infrastructure. We have an equity metric, which is the tons of rescued building materials that can be received by nonprofits, small businesses, and communities that are in their environmental justice communities. So it's trying to do climate action, economic recovery, and justice with as many strategies as possible, trying to weave those three overarching principles into as many strategies as possible.
About the vision for San Francisco, Do you see that reflected strongly in the action plan? Could you sort of link the vision to the action plan and strategy?
Yeah, I know it's, I think that vision for San Francisco is very much being constructed, no pun intended, at the moment. We are still figuring our way through the wave after the pandemic. So the crisis after that crisis was the economic crisis and the shifts that have resulted in how we work, where we work, when we work, and how the city is able to drive things like climate action need to be considered because the way that we would have funded a mission like that needs to be reconsidered. We have something like a 30% vacancy rate in our commercial structures right now. There's really currently no end in sight for that decline. It seems to not have bottomed yet. We have another looming crisis, really, which is the commercial real estate crisis. So, the pandemic happened, then you get the economic crisis where we had so many small businesses shuttered. We are now losing revenue from property taxes in our largest commercial properties that would have otherwise been able to fund a significant push towards objectives like climate action and racial equity. And so that's why economic resilience and recovery is centered at this moment. So the vision is very much being reinvented as we speak. How do you reinvent your city center if these businesses are not going to return at the scale that they were operating at prior to the pandemic? And so the options on the table that are getting a lot of traction are looking at how do you facilitate conversions of commercial space into residential. We have an affordable housing crisis on hand as well. So I think the takeaway for me, though, would be that within all of these interconnected crises is tremendous opportunity. And there are interventions that do present what I would call like the triple word score. If you're a Scrabble fan, it's if you can reinvent a commercial space that will now become affordable housing that brings more foot traffic to your city center and the small businesses return. So reinventing cities is very much, I think, at the top of the list for what the vision for San Francisco is.
That's right. It's like you have to reuse the whole city in a whole new way, isn't it, to make community in again and connect people. You talked about 40 cities, didn't you? How are they doing with respect to this?
When Governor Brown convened the Global Climate Action Summit, there was representation from around the world. And so that initial group became a global working group, a global community of practitioners sharing their experiences, sharing their research. And so I would encourage your listeners, if they're not aware, go check out C40 Cities. It's a C40 Cities Climate Leadership Group. It's now a group of probably 100 or more cities around the world, represents, I think, 1/12 of the world's population and 1/4 of the global economy. I was on a call just this morning with a number of cities sharing updates and progress reports on one of the sub-working groups there called the Clean Construction Accelerator. And so that is looking at like some of the policies, looking at some of the interventions I mentioned already, deconstruction, but things also like adaptive reuse, kind of like what you're saying. We're talking about adaptive reuse at the scale of a city. The whole city center needs to somehow be adaptively reused rather than left vacant. But rather than trying to reuse individual products and materials, how do you leave the whole building intact? The majority of the carbon that was expended to build one of these structures, it's in the foundational concrete and the structural steel. And so if you really want to get the carbon savings, you're going to leave that building intact. And so that's what C40 has evolved into. So yeah, the Global Climate Action Summit, it was a response to, this is where I kind of say there's opportunity in every crisis. And so the crisis was, oh my, the U.S. just pulled out of the Paris Accord. The opportunity was, let's convene and figure out how we keep on track. And from that opportunity, we've now got a global working group, C40, that has grown beyond 40 cities, And as I mentioned, it's, you know, it's representing a significant swath of the world's population and one quarter of the global economy. So that's what C40 is at this point, or that's what those initial 40 cities have become.
You touched into the engagement piece at the start with the built environment, all the different stakeholders, architects, engineers, construction companies. How did you get their buy-in?
You know, getting their buy-in was not as difficult as one would imagine. And I don't know what that is attributed to. It's likely a variety of reasons. I could speculate that some has to do with many of these organizations have embedded within them now a population of practitioners that have grown up in a world where the climate crisis has been front page news for them since childhood. So you have large developers, large contractors, architect firms, where from a very early age, these practitioners were thinking about the unfolding global emergency, the climate crisis. And so that awareness was there, and they refined their understanding through their various fields of study, and they brought that into their trades and professions. And so you have folks in there that are, I think, clamoring to get to the table and contribute to a solution. That's why I say getting their commitment was probably the easy part, because they were already committed. Our challenge was creating the forums where they could convene and offering up a practical pathway for them to engage with one another, talk to one another, share their concerns, and then begin to highlight what they could influence and, dare I say, control within their respective lanes. So, you know, that would just be one attempt to speculate on how we got folks to the table. And a lot of times they were knocking on our door, and it was kind of interesting to hear for the first time variety of nodes in the industry knock on government's door and say, can't you just make our organization do this? Can't you just make a law and tell us to do this? So their concern was there. Their awareness had raised their concern. They were struggling for a way to manifest an intervention. And so they looked government. And for us, we already knew that there's many possible interventions. Laws and policies aren't always the one you should reach for first. And so our job was to start to convene the community. And I always talk about the three P's. You know, the first would be programs, meaning like education, awareness, trainings, grants to get new equipment shifts. How do you ship the practices through awareness and support, not through the sledgehammer of law and policy? That's still on the table. And even those programs could help inform a law if it's necessary. So there's the first P would be programs. The second P would be partnerships. So bringing those private sector actors in conversation with the public sector and seeing what is possible as we work together. And then the final one would be, you know, if there needs to be a policy intervention, can we ensure that it's the most well-informed? Because all too often, policy is not applied like a surgical scalpel. It's going to come at you like a sledgehammer. And so it's usually the last resort.
I have experience working in local government myself in Australia, and in running programs like this, engagement, facilitation of strategy and action plan. I have personal experience doing it. And I found that, you know, you still have to do the engagement across government departments because there's a lot of silos. And you need to get their buy-in so that you can bring these innovations to the table and get approval. So how did you approach that within the San Francisco government?
I don't think much has changed. It's still a very real challenge and barrier to making progress is the siloing off of specialties and siloing off of expertise and programs and various government departments and even within the private sector. You know, you're going to have siloing off within an ecosystem, within an organization. The approach we've taken isn't really favored a lot of times, even though the results might be. And I say that because it's it can take more time initially. And our approach, our playbook, has been rooted in something akin to community-based social marketing, which is you center the stakeholder. And so for this ecosystem, there's a number of stakeholders. And so you kind of go about it pragmatically and systematically, and you center each one in a conversation. And it's about listening before directing or offering input, using your questions as are some of the greatest tools you have, but centering each stakeholder so you can understand their concerns, you can understand their wants, their needs, their strengths, their perceptions or misperceptions of what you are as a government agency. It can be a laborious process, but the fruit that you reap at the end of it is quite valuable. And so you kind of work this playbook over and over again. You go to each node in the system, you center a stakeholder, you get a deep understanding of who they are, what they need, what they want, how they can contribute. And then you start to connect the other stakeholders and you start to highlight where that overlap is, where actually we are more in sync than apart from one another. And you start to elevate that common ground. And that eventually transforms into a common mission, despite everyone still going home at the end of the day to get back in their siloed lane to drive that car of expertise that they're in. It is about the common humanity, the common ground, and the common mission at the end of the day. So that I would say, and it's an iterative process. It's you listen, you convene, you listen, you put some suggestions together, and again, they probably come into the shape of the three P's. You know, here's a potential program intervention, a policy intervention, a partnership intervention. Here's maybe a combination of the three. You pilot that, and then you take those signals in from your pilot, and you deconstruct it. You creatively destroy what's not working. You reinvent it, and you try again. And that's been the playbook we've been running to date.
That's right. In my role, you know, I had to define the role of government. So government really is a facilitator role.
It's quite a process. And I would say at its worst, government is seen as a bureaucrat, a cold, heartless bureaucrat. At its best, it is a public servant. And if that can be at top of mind, how you can be at your best, then you will find ways to be in service to your community. And that is what amounts to centering the stakeholder, is you remember who you're in service to.
It's an amazing piece of work. It's a change of mindset across, it seems like the whole system is required, including government, to have a reflection on themselves of what their real role is, and then allow or offer an opportunity for everyone to do that reflection. So you've done an amazing thing here. And if you had advice for any other city, say in another part of the world, how would you say they would start a process like this if they haven't already?
If you haven't already, I think the first thing you can consider doing is reaching out to someone that you're perhaps drawing inspiration from. That could be a person or an organization, a community of practitioners. Because more often than not, you're going to find they need help. They need resources. They need more people in service to their mission. So if you're finding that there are flints of inspiration out there amongst all the noise of the sour and the dour and the catastrophizing of what's happening, it would be a first step to start knocking on those doors and reaching out. I cannot tell you how many people we've hired into our organization that their journey began with an informational interview. My own journey in this department was kicked off by having one of my colleagues today on my zero waste program. Big hello to Soko Made. She was been with the department for a number of years, and I first met her in my senior seminar at university, and I still have my notebook from that seminar with the note to follow up with Soko. And so just knocking on that door, following those gut intuitive moments, and I tell people all the time, is follow your curiosities with vigor, and eventually you're going to find that path leads to a practice. That practice, if you're lucky, may transform into a passion, and before you know it, it's your life's work. And so I would, you know, start with finding what you're curious about, who is in that field currently that you're finding inspiration, and reaching out to them with questions. And one of your first questions is, how can I help? How can I be in service? How can I be engaged?
So we're coming to the end of our conversation, James. It was such a wonderful story to hear what's happening in the Bay Area. When you think future for cities who take on this approach, what excites you the most?
Well, what excites me the most, as far as what's happening and how you could frame that through the lens of cities, is we're in a truly transformative era. And, you know, there's boundless opportunity here to participate in shaping the world that we're going to hand off to the next generation. I'm inspired because I have a 3-year-old daughter, and I see this opportunity to hand her a city that is going to function a lot differently than the one that I'm living in today. And I see that as my call to duty, if you will, to be at the table, to be participating, to be actively engaged, rather than to be sort of sitting on the sidelines, scowling, passively judging, pointing a finger and blaming. It's much more uplifting and empowering, even though it's not easy work, but it is more uplifting and more empowering to be a part of the process and to walk away at the end of the day knowing I did whatever I could. I did whatever I could to help.
Well, you certainly are a very inspiring person, and it's really important that we share these stories, and that's the whole point of this podcast. So thanks for coming on the show, and I'll keep in touch. We can have an update later at some other point. Thank you very much, James.
Thanks for having me.
This podcast was brought to you by Arcons. Arcons is leading the digital transformation of the AEC and manufacturing industries by providing best-in-class technology solutions from world-leading partners and their own in-house development software from the Arcons B-Smart portfolio for building, infrastructure, and manufacturing. Arcons is a company that cares about creating and building a better world. Together, we are working with industry and environmental experts, providing forums and platforms through our Arcons Think community to create conversations that matter to our future generations. We invite you to join in the conversation and participate in our Think community, so like and subscribe to Think Future to stay up to date with the latest innovations and conversations as we advance the digital journey for AEC and manufacturing around the world. You can download our podcasts at arcons.net or from your favorite podcast platform. From Arcons Think Future, thanks for listening.